Welcome to the Why We Build podcast. Join Steve Wheeler and our host, Greg Waller, to explore the world of remodeling. Whether you're on the production team, design team, or managing the whole show, you can expect insights, tips, and stories that inspire and educate. So let's dive into the Why We Build podcast.
Welcome to the Why We Build podcast. I'm Greg Wallach. Steve Wheeler is off enjoying some time with his family. Please let me know if you have any ideas for the show, maybe a guest suggestion, or perhaps you'd like to be a guest. You can reach out to me at greg@remodelersadvantage.com. Now, today's guest shared a couple of quotes with me before the show. First, there's a quote from a British economist, John Maynard Keynes, who wrote The Page Turner, The General Theory of Employment, Interest, and Money, way back in 1936. Now, he says, worldly wisdom teaches that it is better to fail conventionally than to succeed unconventionally. He also sent one from American investor Howard Marks, a great author as well. Being right in the long run often looks like being wrong in the present. In the remodeling industry, where momentum can mask fragility, these quotes hit home. Now, we've seen companies that look successful on the outside, great projects, full pipelines, busy teams, awesome social media. But underneath, they were financially fragile. Knowing your numbers goes beyond just making a profit. It's what helps you stay strong through ups and downs and build a business that lasts. Now, our guest believes in creating a culture of financial literacy. Creating this culture isn't flashy, but it's foundational. Being financially literate will actually inform decisions. The companies that play the long game tend to be the ones that make it through both the highs and the lows. Now, today's guest knows this all too well. He's seen the consequences of flying blind, and he's also seen the power of mentorship and systems to turn things around. Now, while working for Hudson Valley Preservation with Mason Lord and Dave Seegers, he was part of a peer group that was led by Paul Eldrenkamp, someone who championed long-term financial thinking long before it was popular. Now, that experience and the relationships that came from it reshaped Ian's approach to business. Now, before we dive in, I do want to introduce our guest. Ian Schwand is a 20-year veteran of the construction industry. He got his start through the Carpenters Union Apprentice Program in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. After completing the program, he moved to New York's Hudson Valley region and worked as a site superintendent on a variety of projects in the healthcare sector. Wanting to return to home building, further develop his carpentry skills, Ian worked as a self-employed carpenter and owned an architectural woodworking shop before joining the Hudson Valley Preservation as a lead carpenter in 2017. Now, there Ian developed an interest in high-performance building that he brought back with him to Wisconsin, where he lives in a high-performance home that he built during COVID on his family's farm in southeast Wisconsin. In his spare time, spare in air quotes, of course, Ian enjoys gardening with his wife, Sarah, building furniture, and tinkering with his financial spreadsheets. Ian, welcome to the show.
Greg, great to be on with you.
I really appreciate you being here. What else do you want to tell us about yourself?
I like money. I like thinking about money. I like setting it on fire in my personal life for my own enjoyment. I like working with people that understand the value of it. I grew up with my dad, who's a still farmer at late 60s, and he, in the winter time, he would do accounting for other farmers and he'd help them with their taxes. And I got used to hearing him say things like, it's 100% about the money, 100% of the time. And he's a much more frugal person than I am, but it did inform my thinking.
That's a quote you could have shared with me ahead of time. I like that one as well.
I think I've led a few fine home building articles with that one before.
All right, let's go back to those quotes you shared, what I brought up in the monologue here. You know, why do they resonate with you so strongly?
I got turned on to these different investing books through a few podcasts that I listened to because, you know, like everybody else in my type of a role, I'm interested in what the economy is doing. I'm interested in how it works. And the deeper you get into some of this stuff, the next thing you know, you're, you know, reading Wall Street Journal articles and reading the Financial Times, and you get to read about these different economic theories. And so I just kind of went down these rabbit holes, and specifically to that Howard Marks quote, I think his book, The Most Important Thing, is something that anyone in the financial end of this industry should read or listen to. And if you listen to it as I do, every time he says investment, just pretend he said project. And every time he said capital, pretend he said in-house labor. And you can start to tie in a lot of the things that contractors struggle with: choosing projects, pricing projects right, scheduling them right, having an idea of how long you should give your design team to get through and get a project ready, how long your project managers need not only to ramp the project up in pre-con, but also close it down at the end. And these are all different concepts that, if you can strip the idea that what we do as builders and remodelers is unique and see how it fits in with these other concepts, I've just found it really interesting to look at things through these different lenses. And you know, the fact that it's writing about economics and just plays really well, and you know, certainly plays really well with what we have going on currently.
So one thing I get to, you know, teach and share with different companies and different groups of folks is, you know, profit and how fragile it is. And, you know, why is financial, whether it's gross, net, fragility so common in our world, in construction businesses, even though, you know, people appear to be successful?
I think it's really easy. I shouldn't say easy, but you can fall into a cash flow lull where money comes in, money goes out. Maybe you're the owner and occasionally you buy a boat or take a nice vacation and scrape a little bit off the top. And then you get to the end of the year. Maybe instead of paying 20 grand in taxes, you buy a Bobcat, and you just get used to this. You get used to this system of money coming in and money going out. But then you hit a downtime, or you want to expand. Maybe you want to buy a competitor. And maybe you're an HVAC company like the ones out by me, who all seem to be adding electricians and plumbers and other mechanical contractors. But now you look at your finances and you don't really have any money, even though money's coming in and going out. And I think for me, because I've seen what happens not only with my own business when I had my shop, but also with other companies that I worked for, that when things got bad, you need that cash stuck in the company. And whether you call it operating capital or trade capital, there's a lot of different ways to look at it. And for me, that goes back to the owner of the company I worked for doing the healthcare sector work, where he, because I had an interest in it, sat me down and showed me the books. And I remember him telling me, it's $900,000 a year to keep the lights on here. So we have to do that before we've even made any money at all. And that really resonated with me, because being, you know, whatever I was at the time, 28 years old, that was like an unfathomably large amount of money for me to even think about that this company employing 40 carpenters had to bring in.
In a lot of ways, a lot of different, you know, parts of what we do, we talk about culture. And a phrase that you used was building a culture of financial literacy.
Yeah.
Tell me more about that and how you've done that with your team.
I think it starts at the top. Our leadership team looks at, and we look at our monthly numbers. You know, obviously I'm looking at them a lot more than other people are, but then that trickles down to when I meet with my lead carpenters and project managers for a monthly tactical meeting. I put up last month's financials. I put where we are today, year to date. I look at, you know, the year, the rest of the year. I look at a rolling 12, a rolling 3 with them. And it's just, it's a long game. When Ben bought TDS, he was committed to moving the company toward an open book management system. And that's something that resonates with me because of my interest in the financial end. So it's difficult when you have to deliver bad news. You know, if you have a down quarter and you've got to go out there and tell your whole production team at an all hands that, you know, despite the hard work they've put in and the great work that they've done on projects, you know, we're in a $150,000 hole after the first 3 months, and you have to stand up there as a manager and own that, but also give them, you know, the idea of where we're going from here. I recently had to deliver news like that, and one of my carpenters, junior lead level carpenter, somebody that could run a small project, just, you know, looked at me and said, "So do we have any plans for how we're going to make that up?" And I said, "It's unlikely that we will." And we talked about the long-term view, and we talked about what that means, and talked about it specifically in terms of gross profit, which, if I had one piece of advice on getting that culture of financial literacy, it's focus on the GP number. The revenue of your company is almost meaningless on a day-to-day operational level. It all comes down to whether or not your team, or in an investor parlance like Howard Marks, your invested capital is returning that gross profit.
You know, I think you know, to have your junior level lead carpenter ask that question really shows that this is the type of culture that you're building.
Yeah.
with your team. Now, we have both worked for companies that were great. We both worked for companies that struggled.
We what both worked for a lot of companies, is
we
what you're trying to say.
We both worked for a
lot
of companies. We absolutely did. And we were never the problem. Let's make
never,
that clear. But
never. Had nothing to do with us.
What are some of the first signs that a company, you know, doesn't have that financial literacy culture working for them?
Man, I think when you see people operating their jobs in a way that is maybe absolute quality first, damn the cost, where you see field crews. I've been part of field crews that, you know, they hit the diner for breakfast every morning, and maybe they'd show up on time, maybe they'd be 20 minutes late, but, you know, it'd be 7 hours and take an eight. You know, you see stuff like that, and you start to understand that people aren't thinking about, one, their own position long-term within the company, but more importantly, the long-term health of the company as a whole, and just how that affects everyone else on the team. I try to get everybody to think about how we're a group of people working for a company, and we are relying on each other to make good decisions. And it's easy to see that when you're at a leadership team level and you look at your employees, you look at the people at your all hands, and you know they're looking at you asking that kind of a question that Chris did and wanting to know what the answer is because they're invested in it. They're working there. Their family needs their income from the job. They want to know that their income is secure. So it's really the two different views of how, you know, the boots on the ground act. And I think that extends also to the management level. You know, when you see people buying lots of new trucks, and every November there's a whole shop full of new tools, whether you needed them or not. And the more of that cycle you get into where you're just taking your profit and kind of throwing it away instead of reinvesting it, I think once you're tuned into the gross profit and the kind of profit-driven company mindset, you start to pick up on those actions that other people are taking.
So I think, you know, work with a lot of production managers, that is your title. You have really taken on the finances, I think more so than most would.
Yeah.
How did you start introducing these concepts to the field staff, to the, I mean, even people on the leadership team probably yeah. needed to understand what you were looking for.
When I took over this role, almost 3 years ago now, Ben showed me, I think it was a presentation from an old RA summit, and it was be the CFO of the production department. And it was a short presentation that somebody did, and I can't remember who the company was, but it talked about viewing, being able to view the whole field of your projects, not just now, but understanding how your projects that you've completed turned out, not just from a financial perspective, but through all the different KPIs of how long different things took, and even down to the what percent was your trade partners versus your material versus your in-house labor. So for me, I just started taking these metrics and putting them out there to people at the meetings and talking about why they're important. But for me to build that culture piece, I had to invest a lot of time into my one-on-one interactions with everybody on the team. So whenever we go to a site visit, I try and make sure that I'm having a good conversation with the different people on the job. Sometimes that's financial. Sometimes it's more just, you know, hey, this door still looks wrong. You know, have you taken it out and reset it? But, you know, I think you just have to keep repeating it. What is the thing? You got to say it 8 times before somebody actually realizes that they've heard it.
I'm not sure if that's scientific or not, but I would agree. I can tell you that with kids, it takes a lot of communicating.
Yeah. But it's also the stuff that we've done. Like you came and talked to our entire company about project management and the importance of everybody having a base level understanding of how projects are not just operated, but how they work financially. And I still get members of my team who will make jokes about, I think, I don't remember the context of it, but I think you asked a question of like, you know, what is the worst thing that can happen with a project? And I was like, you know, the downside of a project is infinite bad. It's the world's worst country song if a project goes bad all the way.
But by definition, a project has an end. So that's a good thing to keep in mind.
It could. I think you've worked on a few that you've told me about that you didn't think were ever going to end.
No comment. All right, let's talk about some of the tools you use, system. So what do you use? What kind of tools do you use for tracking these sorts of things?
Two of the most valuable things that I received from a peer group I got from the Poseidon group, the PMRT, through RA that I belonged to in my first 2 years on this job. And one of them was, I got it from Tony Carver at Schlegel Design Remodel in Kansas City. And it was the idea of volume per week. And it was understanding the different size projects, different scopes of projects, and tracking them, tracking how much revenue they produced over the duration that you perform them in, tracking it on an estimated versus actuals level, and you can start to predict how long projects should take. So now when we put an estimate together for a bathroom, basic bathroom, nothing sticks out as fancy, I know what my estimate should be divided by the amount of weeks that I believe it is. And it's a really good check to make sure that you're estimating right, but even more importantly, that you're giving your crew enough time to do the work. Because it'd be very easy for me to go with this $75,000 bathroom instead of it being a 12-week or a 10-week job. And I can tell them all day long that they should do it in 6 weeks until we purchase order the tile guy and he tells us 6 weeks is what he needs for a, you know, an ADA sized roll-in shower. So that's one of the most important things that I got. And I think it was one of the ideas that clicked with that be the CFO of the production department idea. And it gave me a starting point. The other one that I got from the Cleary company in Columbus, Ohio, was the idea of at TDS, we call it the big board, but it's a gigantic spreadsheet where we track all of these different KPIs, whether it's design related, How long did it take from signing the DA to do the design kickoff? How long did it take from the kickoff to the SD sign off, and so on? But it also gives me a place to track things like volume per week, gross profit per day or per week, depending on what metric I'm looking at. And the more of this stuff that I've found that I track, the better I can forecast and predict where things that are in our pipeline that we're not designing right now might end up. And I can start to look at, right now on my big board master schedule, I have projects on there that are starting at the end of this year. So I know in approximately 8 months that as long as this addition marches through the design and sales process the way we believe it will, it's going to land about here on the schedule. It's going to require about this amount of labor to produce it. And I can start to plot out a very long-term forecast of where we're going to be. So it's really that one big tool with all of these different inputs that gives me the long view.
And how does that long view help you with the numbers?
So the long view, and I think it goes to Keynes and Marx's quotes that you started the show with, it gives me the ability to look beyond what's going on now. So if you think about where we are now, we're talking about tariffs, we're talking about having a hard time finding people, we're talking about companies whose phones have stopped ringing because clients are not feeling like they want to spend money right now. But it allows me to look beyond that. And I think that's what knowing and understanding and tracking your numbers should do for you. I've heard Tim Fowler tell the story a few times of some other contractor in DC that he knew that told him he didn't worry about recessions. Recessions come and go, boom times come and go. But he knew all of his numbers. He knew how to forecast. He knew how to plan jobs. And because of that, it allowed him to be dynamic enough to set his company up to succeed.
And I'm sure he never said it is what it is, right?
That's not never.
That guy did.
Never.
So we, gross profit is a really great number for us to look at. Are there any other numbers or ratios that you might use in this system of yours?
Another one that I've started using, especially as a check on my estimating, is this idea of direct labor efficiency ratio, which comes from a accountant, writer, consultant named Greg Crabtree, who has two books called Simple Numbers, Simple Numbers and Simple Numbers 2.0. They're fantastic listens. He also contributed to Vern Harnish's Scaling Up book. For anybody who's read that as part of their business learnings, he did a chapter on gross profit and scaling for that book. But the direct labor efficiency ratio is just simply, for every dollar that I spend on a carpenter, what does that carpenter return in gross profit? And every project's going to have a slightly different profile based on, we all know some projects, it's all management of trade partners. Other projects, like maybe a deck or something like that that's labor heavy, is going to have a different outlook on that number. But it does start to give you another data point related to gross profit, taking it back to your boots on the ground out there performing the work, because they're really the only investment capital we have as a contractor. Yes, we have our funds and our ability to fund a project, but if you can't put boots on the ground to do it, the project's never going to get done, and it's going to hamper your ability to take on jobs. So those people who do the work are really our investable capital as a company.
So I want to go back to team buy-in, sort of a mindset shift. Have you encountered resistance? I'm thinking field staff, but have you encountered any resistance when trying to introduce this transparency, this understanding of the numbers, and what did you do to handle it?
Sometimes I think the resistance is more just, it's a really foreign concept to people, that that you would operate a business telling everybody how last month turned out, whether it was good or not. So I think it's more about the educational piece. And I've found that the people who are dead set resistant against it either don't understand the numbers enough themselves, or they just have an outlook on the people who do the work where it's the, you know, the mushroom thing, keep them in the dark. And that's the way they would rather operate. And that isn't going to work with our core values. So just even in our hiring process, it's important for us to be self-selecting for people who are open to these ideas and want to be lifelong learners, want to understand how the company's doing so they can be, you know, engaged team players. And that's what our focus is.
Yeah, we've you know, talked before, and I do know how important culture and core values is to your company. So I can imagine that it is sort of a prerequisite to be, you know, well-informed, or at least understand the value of it within your structure.
And we haven't gotten as good at not making the occasional bad hire as we should be at this juncture in our operating of the business, but we're pretty good at sniffing them out after a couple of months. And you find some people just don't fit with that system.
So in the intro, we mentioned Paul Eldenkamp, also Mason Lord, Dave Seegers. These are all people that you and I know personally, and they're, you know, really strong. They're just really strong. They're people that I, you know, I've learned a lot from in my connection with them. But besides those guys, is there anyone else, you know, really influential mentors that helped you with these numbers?
One of the first people that I met when I started getting this idea that I wanted to get out of the field, I met David Gerstel at JLC Live. And I had just kind of not read his book, Nail Your Numbers, but, you know, read it as well as I was capable of. And I went to both of his presentations, and I waited in line, you know, outside, as some nerds do, to talk to the presenter at JLC Live. And I had a great conversation with him, and I reached out to him through his website and just said, "Hey, probably don't remember me. Met you at JLC Live. I read your book. I'd love it if I could, you know, talk to you on the phone for 15 minutes or send you an email of some ideas that I have about my future career." And, you know, that turned into a good solid 2 years of back and forth that I had with David. And one of the byproducts of that was he also introduced me to Clay DeCorn, who is the executive editor of JLC, who was instrumental in helping me become a writer for both JLC and Fine Home Building. But beyond that, what I realized later on was what Clay and David were teaching me to do through that mentoring was how to explain myself and how to talk about an idea that I'm passionate about so that somebody else might, you know, pick up on some of that passion or get a new idea from the way that I'm presenting something.
I love that about our industry. You know, I really feel like so many people are so giving. Same thing. I've had touches with all those folks, and they've really you know, helped me along, and for whatever reason, invested their time into us. And I think that's a wonderful thing.
Yeah. I had a great conversation with Paul Eldenkamp one time at a coffee shop in Kent, Connecticut, of all places. And he could see that I was struggling with not just my career, but just bigger picture kind of life in general. And I made the comment to him that, you know, a sailor without a destination cannot hope for a favorable wind. And he really, at first, Paul being Paul, he laughed pretty heartily at that. And then he kind of latched onto it of like, you know, let's break this down and understand what's behind it. And what you're telling me that you need direction, you know, where do you get direction in your life? What are your goals? And, you know, Paul has that kind of fatherly mentor way that he can pick up on a comment like that and really dig into it with you.
Yeah. Yeah. Paul, super, super person, very personable. I love the way he talks. It's very calming.
Yeah.
You know, I think I like that about him. But
yeah.
So other production managers, they want to bring this into their companies. what's the first thing they should do, or just maybe one piece of advice you'd give to them?
For me, it really took off for me when I started to develop a really good working relationship with the woman in our office who is on our leadership team and does the bookkeeping, runs QuickBooks, pays the bills, and she is our, finance manager. And I've talked to a lot of production managers over the years through RA and through other gatherings, and they don't even know who the person is. They don't talk to them. They don't have a relationship with them. So I think that's where it's got to start. When Tanya and I started working together on a lot of things very closely during some tough cash flow times, I realized that my not understanding the basics of accrual accounting was stopping me from understanding what she was talking about. So just, one weekend, all I did was listen to podcasts about accrual accounting. And, two weekends of that, you get enough of a base level understanding of what you're talking about to ask intelligent questions.
All right, so this is a kind of a fun segment now. We're going to get to know a little bit more about Ian. I'm going to start with the book question. What's your favorite? And I know you read a lot or listen to a lot like I do. What would be your favorite fiction or nonfiction that you would recommend?
I'll give you one of each. The nonfiction is going to be Infinite Game, Simon Sinek. Fiction is probably going to have to be Great Gatsby.
Okay. Who would play you in a movie about your life in the trades?
It's a good one. I would have went with Harrison Ford before he got before he got too old, just because he is a carpenter. So I feel like he could have pulled it off. So I'll still go with him. They can, CGI him down to my age.
I would go with him too. That would be, he's been my pick for this icebreaker other times. So.
Yeah, another good one would be Liam Neeson, because he was also a joiner
Okay.
before he was a famous actor.
All right. Either one. Not
I'll
that you
take
need my
both of them.
approval, but yeah, good
Yeah.
stuff. Good stuff. All right. If you could have lunch or dinner with any person, dead or alive, from the trades, from architecture, from history, who would it be?
Ooh, you want me to stick with the industry, though? You kind
I
of
think
opened it up
so.
there at the end.
Well,
Oi, anybody dead or alive, huh? I think I'm going to go with this architect named Steve Bass. Believe still alive. Another writer, teacher. He probably doesn't realize that he was a mentor for me on some level, but I met him through the, I think it's the ICAA, which is a classical architecture thing in New York City. I think he'd be a fascinating guy to talk to for an hour.
all right. What would you eat? What would what dinner?
I don't know. I think he and I would probably just stand out like in Midtown somewhere and have a shawarma on the side of the street.
That sounds about right. I like to hear that. Any last nugget you want to give to the audience?
Take care of your mental health. I went through a really challenging period toward the end of last year, and Greg's one of the people that I leaned on pretty heavily during that time period. And you do have to realize there's a reason why on that stupid thing they make you listen to on the airplane before you take off, that they tell you to put the mask on yourself first. And I went through a long period where I felt like I had to never put the mask on. And over the last, few months, I'm trying to teach myself that, when things are rough, you do have to take care of yourself first. So, and I think the mental health importance is starting to creep its way through the trades, but it could use another bump.
That was really good advice, Ian. Thank you so much for sharing that. Thank you for joining us. Where can we find you?
Start with Instagram at IJS Woodworking, and just shoot me a DM. I try to answer just about everything that anybody sends me. And if it's something that turns into more of a long-term talking about life, talking about building stuff and money, and we can turn it on to email and maybe hook up someday.
Really great stuff, Ian. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Greg.
That's it for this episode of the Why We Build podcast. We hope you found something valuable to take back to your team. If you enjoyed the show, be sure to subscribe and leave a review. Please send in your ideas for future episodes. Thanks for listening, and we'll catch you on the next one. If you want more information about our roundtables program, production manager groups, design manager groups, consulting services, or any of the Remodelers Advantage offerings, please visit remodelersadvantage.com or email Greg at remodelersadvantage.com.